Hey, what's up, Ricky? Oh, wrong hand. I got to.
Should humans have dominion over the animals?
No.
I don't know if they should, but we do.
We have power over them. I don't think we have dominion over them granted to us by some godhead.
I think the Bible says that humans should have dominions over the animals.
I think what else it says, rape the land and kill the animals or something like that.
But at the same time, we have a responsibility to look out for their welfare also.
Dominion. I think we assume that we will make decisions for the animals while making decisions for ourselves. However, if I could understand that the animals found that to be unacceptable, but at this point, I don't know that the animal truly morally objects.
Get everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
That's how it is out here.
During the next half hour, Earth on the Air's grassroots contributors explore some of the ways we humans relate to the other animals around us.
We'll eavesdrop on a roundtable discussion about the ethics of modern meat eating.
We'll visit a man who's discovered a dietary supplement that can turn your cat into a vegetarian.
Also, thoughts on animal rights. Who says animals even have rights?
Storyteller John Mullen, thoughts from the streets, and more.
First, animal rights activists occasionally find themselves in camps opposing environmentalists. Usually it's when efforts to protect ecosystems collide with the lives of individual animals. A drive up to Klahani Ridge in Washington State's Olympic National Park, producer Gordon Black asked the Park Service's Paul Crawford to take him up to this breathtaking alpine lookout.
It goes from about sea level to about 5,000 feet, so we'll be rising a mile or so.
Black wanted to try to spot some of the fragile native plants of the area, the Fletz violet, the Piper's harebell, or a delicate variation of the loco weed. He didn't see any, partly because it was raining, but also because these rare plant species almost died out here during the past few years. Mountain goats thought they were pretty tasty and were busily devouring all they could when in 1989 the Park Service captured the Klahani goats and relocated them to forests in eastern Washington and Idaho.
Klahani Ridge was a conspicuous place where the impact really showed up because it was close to the road, it was easily accessible, and it was one of the most highly impacted areas. Since we removed the goats, we have seen recovery, but other parts of the park are, if not equally impacted, significantly impacted.
Goats in other areas of the national park are still feasting on plant life, and Paul Crawford says there are over 1,000 goat wallows, which can threaten the delicate ecosystem even more than grazing.
I'm not sure whether it's to rid themselves of parasites or to cool off or whatever, but they just like to paw through the soil and then wallow around in the dust and the sand and the grit. I'm not exactly sure why.
So the net result is, though, that they cause soil erosion and remove plants?
Right. And from one wallow, we calculated that 40 tons of soil had been lost by breaking through the soil. And in the high country up here, that's a very significant loss.
The few hundred goats in the Klahani Ridge area were relatively easy to remove. They were accessible and weren't particularly timid. Still, the removal cost per goat was about $1,000. They were chased, netted, tranquilized, flown by helicopter, and trucked down the highway. Elsewhere in the park, goats that have not yet been removed are less accessible, and park rangers say using helicopters to capture them would just be too dangerous. So, what to do with the remaining 400 or 500 mountain goats?
There are quite a few people that think we should leave the goats alone, period. There are animal rights groups in contact with us. There are Native Plant Society folks in contact with us. There are hunters that think, yes, the goats ought to be removed and the hunters ought to be allowed to do it. So there's certainly no unanimity of a public opinion.
Polly Dyer, president of the Olympic Park Associates, speaks for most conservationists when she says the goats need to be removed by any means necessary.
Our goal is to see the Olympics continue to evolve in a natural state, and the mountain goats do not help that.
So nothing less than total removal of the goats would be acceptable to you?
That is correct, because if you leave any goats, you're going to have them proliferating.
So are you in favor of a shoot-to-kill policy operated by the Park Service?
Yes, I think that that's the only way to handle that, is to have the rangers who are deputized to do that, to shoot the goats, to remove them.
Animal advocates argue that the goats' impact on park plant life has been exaggerated. Wayne Johnson of the Northwest Animal Rights Network adds that people like him who defend the goats are also concerned about the plants.
It's just, if you say to me flat out, if it's a plant or a goat, one of the two, are we going to let the goat eat the plant or are we going to shoot the goat with a rifle? I'm saying we're going to let the goat eat the plant. But we are also going to try to form some way of having our cake and eating it too by protecting the plants from the goats, given the fact that the goats are going to eat some plants. That's what goats do. Goats eat plants. And they don't deserve to die because they eat plants.
As a compromise, Johnson says he'd support a sterilization program for the goats, an option that the Park Service says is probably too costly. Government agencies are now studying the goat situation and preparing an environmental assessment. But the Park Service says, so far, shooting the goats seems to be the only practical way to protect the Olympics' natural, pristine environment. This assumes the goats are not native to the peninsula. And this is the point upon which the Park Service argument for removal hinges. It's widely believed that the goats were imported to the Olympics by sport hunters earlier this century, and therefore their impact is not considered natural. But there's a hitch. Some anthropologists point to evidence that the goats are native to the peninsula. The Park Service's Paul Crawford.
Yes, unfortunately, there is some evidence that suggests that. There's also a lot of evidence that suggests just the opposite. What we're doing now is we're going to do a complete review of the historic and archaeological and the anthropological record and assemble all this material and then turn it over to a reputable team of scientists that we won't even choose. It'll be independent of the Park Service for their evaluation to say yes or no.
Animal rights activists like Wayne Johnson have latched onto the historical ambiguities in defending the goats, but say they're not relying on this argument alone. Johnson says even if the goats were imported, it's not as if they had any say in the matter, and it's wrong to punish them for it.
The way man usually corrects man's mistakes is by making the animals pay, and that's what we're against in terms of the goat population up there. We're against making the goats pay, and I want to emphasize again, the goats have already paid a huge price. If you could prove, theoretically at least, or even definitively, that the goats were introduced in the 1920s by hunters, the goats should not have to pay the price for it. 800 goats have already died or been translocated because of that.
Most conservationists agree with Polly Dyer that preserving whole ecosystems should take precedence over the rights of individual animals.
Olympic National Park is probably, except for the goats and some other things, one of the more pristine areas in the lower 48 states. It is as close to something that hasn't been altered drastically as there is.
The Park Service's Paul Crawford says the main problem with shooting the mountain goats is that it's a hard option to sell to the general public.
They really look as if they belong here. They're an indigenous North American species. They're native to the high mountains of the West. And people are very fond of them. They're photogenic. And quite frankly, many of us in the park staff are quite fond of them too. We don't have a vendetta against goats at all. But from an ecosystem perspective, we feel we need to either get rid of them or cut way back on the number of goats.
All right, is it ever okay for humans to take the lives of animals?
Well, I mean, like for hunting, I mean, if it's your only source of food.
If the animals were a threat to humans' life.
If it's like really necessary, like Indians killing fish for food, because if you like really need it, then I think it's all right.
Is it ever okay for humans to take the lives of animals?
Yeah, of course it is.
I don't think so. There's too many road kills, there's too many factory farms.
No, and I'm willing to go out and kill an animal if it's so that I can live.
For some medical research, yeah, I think it's okay. Without that research, we might not be able to cure certain diseases.
I think that the earth belongs to humans and animals, and we share it, we don't own it. That's how I see it.
Do animals have rights in the same way we like to think humans do? It's a question Scott Bergen's been thinking about lately. Bergen is a graduate student of forestry at the University of Washington.
That they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thomas Jefferson claimed these rights for all men in the Declaration of Independence. By men, Jefferson meant white males of European descent. Later, these same men were given a new list of rights in the Bill of Rights: the right to free speech and assembly, the right to have a gun, the right not to incriminate yourself in court. It was a long time before women and people of other races shared the same rights as white men in this country, and now, apparently, the question is moving beyond the rights of people to the rights of animals. But what exactly are rights? Jefferson believed that certain rights are given to us by God. Do all rights stem from some higher power? What about the right to own a shotgun? So are there different kinds of rights, or are they all just privileges and protections granted to members of society by society, rules that govern how we all treat each other? It is clear that among all the people of the world, there is no one set of agreed-upon universal human rights. Killing or stealing or enslaving has always been acceptable under certain conditions in certain cultures. So what rights do animals have? Do they have a set of rights independent of human existence? Do they have a God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? If not, if rights are purely a societal phenomenon, then the question isn't what rights do animals have, but what rights should we humans give them? And if this is the question, then there are as many shades of answers as there are people. For instance, in the book of Genesis, God charges man to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Native Americans, on the other hand, while using animals, worshipped and respected their spirits. And how do your rights stack up to an animal's? If a grizzly bear mauls you while you're out camping in the woods, have your rights been violated? If you go and shoot the bear, are you violating its rights? Does it depend on whether it was in self-defense? Many people seem to walk a fine line on animal rights. They will eat meat, but only if the animals have been treated humanely. They support animal research, but only if it will save human lives and there is no perceived alternative. Are these people hypocrites? Should they be against all exploitation of animals? Or is it just too personal a question? Should we be pro-choice on the matter? It's a tough question because pro-choice means pro-murder or pro-slavery to some. The 13th Amendment to the Constitution abolished slavery in this country. There are 27 amendments right now. When it comes to animal rights, are we ready for number 28?
Is it ever okay for humans to take the lives of animals?
I think only for the sake of our own survival. Not for sport, not for fun, but for eating.
Okay, do you eat meat?
Very, very small amounts.
Do you eat meat?
Yes, I do. I eat red meat. I don't have any problem with eating beef or, you know, chicken or anything.
I mean, I'm a vegetarian unless I can kill food myself, because I know what happens to meat before it's put in a styrofoam tray and sent to a supermarket.
Because meat isn't healthy for you at all, with all the hormones they put in it, and also because I don't feel right taking someone else's flesh and putting in my body when I know all the horrors that it had to go through to get on my plate.
We're on top, somewhat on top of the food chain, and we have control of it. We have a choice of what we put in our mouth or not.
Most of us could safely stop eating meat if we chose to. Many people are cutting back on animal products for health reasons. But what about the nagging ethical question? Is it right to eat meat at all? Paul Kinsey, a philosopher at Towson State University in Maryland, probes into the problem in the second part of a two-part roundtable discussion with student Luke Coleman and Susan Brebner, a spokesperson for the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Kinsey asked Brebner for a thumbnail sketch of the argument against eating meat.
Well, of course, animals that are raised to provide meat are usually raised in pretty horrifying conditions. It's no longer the kind of situation where we have the old farm where the animals are out in the pasture, living in the sunlight and grazing, and then are killed right there on the farm. What we have now are huge agribusiness concerns that keep animals in intensive confinement. And the animals may be kept in very small cages. For instance, eggs. When you walk into the average grocery store, the eggs in that store have almost always come from a factory farm situation where you may have 6 or 8 chickens kept in a cage maybe 18 inches by 18 inches. They're so crowded they can never spread their wings. They can form no natural social structure, so to prevent them from cannibalizing each other, they have to have their beaks cut off with a hot knife. And after a very short, unnatural life, they're taken to the slaughterhouse, where they may not be dead before they're immersed into the tank of boiling water. So that's the kind of thing that's involved in the modern meat industry. And we don't need to kill animals in order to survive.
See, I grew up in a small town in Indiana, and all my relatives were farmers. And they lived on the old-fashioned kind of farm where, people killed their own meat and so forth. I mean, it was just a fact of life. And I guess I still feel somehow we're carnivorous animals, and I just can't feel very strongly against eating meat. I don't eat very much.
This is an interesting claim, I think, because what would you have said in an earlier age to someone who said, we are aggressive animals, or we are animals in whom the male dominates the female? Would that sort of remark have carried conviction for you?
There is a question of might makes right. Is that the way we live?
Well, but I think what I'm getting at is the question whether the fact that the practice fits into a long history says anything by way of justification of the practice.
Well, yes and no. I mean, when I look at a peregrine attacking another bird, I don't find that offensive. I see that's natural.
But the peregrine falcon, A, has no alternatives, and we do have alternatives, and B, the peregrine falcon is probably not capable of regulating its conduct ethically, and okay, we are
right,
capable.
Right. And so certainly I eat a lot of soybean products. I know people in West Virginia who are out-of-work miners. They hunt deer, and that puts meat on the table. And I think that's getting back to some kind of need to take whatever food is available. There are really two things going on, I think. We are these primitive creatures that eat meat. We are also rational creatures that can choose not to do that. Eating a chicken doesn't bother me very much.
But it bothers the chicken. It's very hard on the chicken.
My mother always killed the chickens that we ate. See, I'm still looking back at what I grew up with. So I realize that the modern way of raising meat is something that's very offensive. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's important. More and more people are starting to feel that way. I think we've realized that our society has gotten so caught up in these kind of large institutions, whether it's a research institution or the military-industrial complex or anything else, that we have lost touch with the natural world completely, and we have allowed institutions to develop that are so far disconnected from reality and from empathy and from compassion that they wreak a lot of destruction on the natural world. Once people start to realize that and become dissatisfied with that kind of a world, then they have to think, what can I do to put my feelings into action? And that doesn't mean, for instance, that you have to walk out of here and become a vegetarian overnight, but it should mean perhaps that you think about ways that you can reduce the amount of animal suffering that you are directly participating in.
kitty, kitty, kitty. You want to eat now? Want to eat?
The familiar ritual, feeding the cat, has for some cat owners taken a new twist. Breakfast is no longer from a can, and it's now possible, according to these adventurous feline lovers, to serve it up 100% vegetarian. The carnivorous nature of cats has presented an ethical dilemma for those who have chosen not to eat meat out of respect for animals, but have at the same time had to buy it for their cats. James Peden's Sandpoint, Idaho company, Harbingers of a New Age, developed a vegetarian supplement for pets in 1985. Peden and his wife, Kathy, recommend several meatless recipes for cats.
It's mashed garbanzo beans, veggie cat, nutritional yeast, oil, canola oil, and imitation bacon bits. And that's all, right, dear?
That's all.
Okay, that's it.
Through the ages, cats have evolved to depend on flesh for certain essentials, traditionally thought to be found only in meat. The amino acid taurine, arachidonic acid, and preformed vitamin A. Without these, cats are prone to blindness, heart disease, and premature death. Peden claims to have found synthetic or plant sources for these and other nutrients, which he has combined in his food supplement.
VeggieCat is the supplement that contains the minerals, the vitamins, and the fatty acids that are essential for a cat that we were not able to come up with in a natural diet that a person could prepare at home for them. And what was missing, that's what we put into the computer and found sources for that didn't come from animals. And that's what is in VeggieCat.
According to Peden, the basic ingredients of common cat foods are grains. It's the slaughterhouse waste found in commercial cat food, meat products considered unfit for human consumption, that he objects to. Over 2 billion tons of these meat byproducts are used each year by the pet industry. Peden argues that if it's not suitable for humans, it's probably not good for pets.
This is food that has been killed or slaughtered months before the cat finally consumes it. When you feed a cat this way, it's the furthest thing from a natural diet for that cat. Now, what we're doing for that cat is also not natural, but we have withstood the test of time, 6 years, 7 years of extraordinarily good health. And when we put this food down in front of the cats, I hear no complaints.
Peden argues that a vegetarian diet eliminates the stench from the kitty litter box, helps relieve cats of fleas, and has other health benefits. Some veterinarians, however, aren't so sure. Dr. R. L. Weisung of Midland, Michigan, considers the vegetarian cat phenomenon an experiment. While Weisung's company also produces meatless pet foods, he recommends the addition of fresh raw meat. That is, if the cats are not out catching their own prey. Weisung fears that removing the cat from its genetic context and converting it to a strict vegetarian diet may be asking for trouble. Nonetheless, James Peden says that about 1,000 pet owners are happily using his veggie supplements. One of them is Bernadette. She's an animal lover from Los Angeles who cares for about 20 cats who she's adapted to be vegetarian. Why does she do it?
We have a very large environmental movement. People talk about hurting the earth. Well, if we're not going to hurt the earth and we're not going to hurt people, let's not hurt animals either. We're all part of the same fabric. We have pets, though, because we feel that we are caretakers on the earth. We are taking care of them in the best way that we can, which includes certainly shelter and love, taking them to the vet when they're sick. But also it includes giving them the best diet possible. And we believe that a vegetarian diet is the best diet possible for them.
Those interviews were from Jane Fritz in Sandpoint, Idaho, and Vanessa May in Los Angeles.
Is there anything wrong with having animals as pets?
No. Cats and dogs, no. But exotic birds and such, I would say, yeah.
It depends how you treat them.
I don't know. People are too cruel to their animals, in my opinion.
They're not the same kind of animal that can fend for themselves like they used to be.
It's like we have to help them provide a home for them and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
fur on the steering wheel was my first clue, but I didn't pay much attention to it. Then, as I backed out of the driveway, the empty bottle of Old Crow rolled out from under my seat with more fur and whiskers around the mouth of the bottle. The crow on the label had scratch marks down its back. I hit the brakes and watched the abacus in my mind hit the total button. Helen, my cat, was getting drunk and taking the car out after I was in bed. My brain started shooting out a ticker tape of denials. Maybe the neighbor's cat did it. Maybe I did it. Maybe Helen was just drinking in the driveway. But she shouldn't be drinking at all. And the gas tank was low. But not as low as I was feeling right then. I went right back into the house and confronted Helen about it. Helen, whose bottle of Old Crow is this? You're lying. It's your fur on the bottle. So is this why you sleep all day? Knocking off a hangover? Oh, and then you have to go out every night just as it's getting dark, just before the liquor store closes. Well, who's buying it for you? I was furious. I pulled the blanket out from under her, and out flew my old license, the one I thought I lost. She had cut out a picture of herself and taped it over my face. This was how she was getting the booze. Like most pet owners, I never had to deal with this before and didn't know what to do. I heard about these pet psychologists and decided to give it a try. Mr. Mullen, your cat is an alcoholic. My head spun. Is there anything we can do? Is there a 12-step program we can get Helen into? Well, for animals, it's a 24-step program because of their extra set of legs, but it's going to take a lot of hard work and commitment on both your parts. Helen and I started the program right away. After only a few sessions, I realized how in my relationship with Helen, I was the enabler, always filling her food dish, letting her sleep whenever she wanted, even opening doors for her. But we're working on changing all of that. Helen spends her evenings at home now, doing a lot of reading about healing her and her kitten. If she does go out at night, it's just to chase a ball of yarn around the carport or hunt mice, things she never got to do when she was young. I'm learning to trust Helen again, and even offered to let her use the car the other night. Right now, I'm excited and scared about the things Helen and I are going to discover as she walks further down that 24-step road.
Seattle performance artist and storyteller John Mullen.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't forget, this is your program, too. We invite you to take part in Earth on the Air's ongoing radio dialogue.
Find out about becoming a member of the Earth on the Air Radio Works and receive a copy of our submission guidelines.
Write us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Earth on the Air's submissions director is Susan Gleason. Our executive director is Craig McDonald. The show is produced and edited by Peter Maloff and Suzanne Tedesco, engineered by Scott Bergen.
We had additional help from Chris Wade, Jean-Paul Bardou, Aaron Herridge, and Lowell Harvey.
Also, thanks to KUOW and the Dubtrain Cassette Duplicating Services in Seattle.
Music was by Indigo Girls, Michael Stipe, David Hines, and Randy.
Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle and KSER in Linwood, Washington.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation, Resist, and the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you'd like program number 23. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, this is Peter Maloff.
And I'm Janice Kane.